Welcome to Portland Eye and Ear Control, the podcast brought to you by the Creative Music Guild. I'm Ben Cates, the Artistic Director.
And I'm Brandon Conway, the Board President. Today we talk with Matt Hanifin.
Matt's so interesting to talk with because he plays in a way that you don't see anyone else play. He plays on the floor. He has all these percussion instruments from around the world. You could say that he's sparse, but I think the word that might describe his playing best is thoughtful. And I don't mean that in a cerebral way. I just mean he hits the drum and he's hit it. Maybe the word to describe it then is intention. The word that describes his playing best is probably intention. Every movement, every sound is filled with intent.
Matt is such a fantastic and fascinating player, and even though I've known him for a long time, I don't think we've had a chance to talk about his musical background and how he's integrated these various influences and different instruments. And I was really excited to have this conversation with him about that. Let's talk to Matt.
So, yeah, it's a busy day. Kept telling the kids, but we got to be in bed by 8:45, because I have to go.
And it worked.
It worked.
Excellent. Yeah. Is it helpful when they can tell time?
They can't tell time.
Oh, they can't tell time. Okay. I was going to say, because it's like...
I said 8:45, like, in, you know, soon.
Yeah. I'm like, well, it's super late. She has no idea.
Yeah.
It's like... I can't tell time. Kate, yes. Is it bedtime?
That's pretty much it. Is it bedtime? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, the boys gave me such a hard time, like in the middle of summer, you know, because it's still light out at all. And you're like, it's really late. And they're like,
no, it's not.
No, it's not. Yeah. It's still light out.
What are you talking about?
It's like, and then trying to explain that is kind of a lost cause. And then kind of understand the concept of what you're saying, but like, it's not really registering.
The sun goes down later in the summer. Why should they believe that?
Yeah, sure, Dad. No. Could try.
They believe that.
We're not that dumb. it's funny. We often like to start with your musical start.
Yeah.
Like, did you start in band in school, or what was your path?
Well, it's actually funny, and I figured you'd ask that, so I started thinking about it. And these days, I really had to think about things beforehand, so I thought about it, and I thought... Most people, you know, when they had some interest in music to start out, it's pretty obvious. I didn't. Because growing up, my mom and dad are both performers. My father went to Juilliard for voice. He's a classical singer. And my mother was a dancer, a ballet dancer. Still is, I guess, but she hasn't done it in years. So growing up, I didn't even listen to music. Like, we didn't have records around the house. We didn't listen to the radio. Because what I heard was my dad singing. He would sing all the time around the house. And you know, that was the music we had. And we had maybe a dozen records. We had, you know, the Man of La Mancha soundtrack, you know, things like that. Or not soundtrack, original cast recording.
We had that too.
Especially. Yeah, it was a great record.
On record, yeah. Yeah. The LP.
Uh-huh. The yellow cover with mm-hmm. the Hirschfeld. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So growing up, you know, that was the music I heard. It was my dad singing show songs, because he was, at that point, he was making most of his living doing shows. You know, he wasn't on Broadway when I was a kid, but he would go out to travel, you know, do various theaters, you know, all the classic musicals of the time. So that's what I heard growing up.
Where was this?
We lived in New Jersey at that point, New York and then New Jersey. And I didn't even develop the concept that people listened to recorded music until I was in high school, I think. You know, it just didn't really... You know, that's not true. No, it must have been like eighth grade, because I remember having a couple of 8-tracks at that time. And but even then, it was just like, you know, I got a couple because, you know, friends of mine had that record, so I bought that record. And I didn't really have a defined interest in music forever. And it didn't really kick in until college. I had listened to some, you know, I had some things that I listened to. I had some records. But it wasn't, there was no focus to it. And then the college I went to in New Jersey, they had the college radio station had an annual event called the Radiothon. Where they brought in bands from, you know, mostly from New York that came out. We weren't that far outside the city. And I went because it was happening, you know, it was on the campus, and I said, I'll go to that thing. A friend of mine and I went, and it was, this was 1984, and there was just a lot going on in New York at that time. There were some really great bands going on. That was the time, like, Sonic Youth was just starting to become a thing. They didn't play this, but a lot of the bands that were in that ilk played at this event. And it blew my mind. I had never heard anything like this. And it was really rhythmic, and there were all these different, you know, the tunings were incredible. And I that was it. Like, that moment, that's when I said, I'm interested in music now. And it became a thing. And the next year, I joined that radio. Was it the next year? Actually, I left the country for a while. I studied in Ireland for a semester. And when I came back, I joined the radio station. And I started going through the record library. And that was it. Like, that's when music just kicked in for me. And I was introduced to a lot of the early industrial music, like Einstürzende Neubauten and Zev Test Department was going then, and you know, that was all percussion based. It was all percussion, and I thought, oh, I can do that. And I had a couple friends, and we started collecting scrap metal. You know, filled up my garage with my parents' garage with scrap metal, and that was it. You know, it sort of took from there. But that was. You know, it was very fairly fast thing. Like nothing for 20 something years, you know, 21 years or so, and then whammo. I don't know why. I don't know whether I was waiting to hear the right thing. Maybe that's how everybody does it. I don't know. But instantly it became like the thing that I thought about all the time. And it's progressed, you know, there's actually a pretty, a fairly logical progression from there.
So growing up, your parents didn't, like, there wasn't a, they didn't want you to have, like, a musical education?
They always asked. They said, do you, you know, we had a piano in the house. And neither one of them played it, but we had it. And it was really badly out of tune. But they always, you know, every once in a while they'd say, so, do you want to learn to play piano? Do you want to learn to play something else? And I said, no. I just didn't have any interest. I actually did take clarinet lessons when I was in sixth grade because my school started a band program. Like, you know, that guy with the instruments comes in and does the little show and you get to pick an instrument. And I think I did it for 6 months and I never practiced. I still have the clarinet though. It's a Wurlitzer, plastic Wurlitzer clarinet. Awesome. But yeah, there was just this complete lack of interest. Just nothing hit me. You know, nothing hit me that I really wanted to spend time doing that until, and I don't know whether it's that, I don't know whether it was that I was looking for a percussive thing that I hadn't been hearing. And then when I heard it, you know, because a lot of the bands that I first got interested in were very, you know, they had multiple percussionists or they had just very interesting senses of rhythm. There was a lot of strange things going on then. I got into the industrial thing and that was, you know, Zev in particular, I don't know if you're familiar with him at all. He's this guy, he's from California originally. Been around forever, he's still around. Started playing in the 70s. Developed this solo percussion act that he was using mostly scrap titanium and with a lot of reverb on it. So it'd be this huge, resonating, massive sound that he'd get all by himself. And that just completely blew me away. And I thought, you know, I want to do that. So I started doing that. That was a theme for a while. Like, here is some guy, and, you know, I guess everybody does this, you know, oh, I want to do that. You know, I'm gonna pretend to be that guy for a while. So I pretended to be one of those guys for a while. And I played with a couple of bands in college, you know, just, you know, played percussion here and there. And after that, I started broadening out a bit. This is all intricately tied up with the history of recorded music. Is in the mid to late 80s, the transition from LPs to CDs happened, which meant that all of the record stores were dumping their LPs for nothing, you know, like a dollar each. I'd cut them all out, throw them in a bin. So I was buying all these LPs, and that's when I discovered that there were, you know, music from other parts of the world. I started buying a lot of African stuff, a lot of Indian music. Got a record by Ala Raka, tabla player, solo tabla record. Said, wow. Got a lot of Brazilian stuff. There was a guy named Nana Vasconcelos who completely tripped me out because he had a very defined, very small, defined palette of sounds. Shakers, a couple of drums, not much. He would sing, he would do rhythmic stuff singing. And it was this very small, defined sound world that he created for himself. And that was completely the opposite of where I'd been coming from for a few years, which was, you know, a lot of scrap metal, like giant sounds, huge, angry. And instead, on this, you know, on the other side, is this guy, this tiny little palette of sounds. He would create the beautiful music with it. I said, I should do that. You know, that's all right. That's the direction I should go. I should do that thing. And also, it doesn't weigh a ton. You know, I can carry it around. So I imitated him for a while. You know, this is the process. I was in my 20s, imitating everybody, and I did that for a little while. And then I realized, well, I'm not really getting anywhere. And I studied a little bit of African music, and a little bit of this. So I was doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit. And I realized after a while that I really wasn't learning anything. I wasn't getting anywhere. I didn't have a voice. I just had, you know, I could do this rhythm from that kind of thing, this rhythm from that kind of thing, this rhythm from that kind of thing. But nothing, there was not, I wasn't developing anything that was my own. So at that point I started imitating somebody else. There was this guy, Glenn Velez. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's still around too. He's a brilliant percussionist. He started this whole movement of synthesizing different frame drums from around the world into a synthetic style He brought techniques from all over, and it was he was able to create again a very focused sound for himself, and it was adaptable. Like you could use that palette in a lot of different kind of music, and I thought, well, that's a great thing. So I should do that. Yeah. So I started. So I actually went and studied with him, and with one of his main students. And I studied with them for a while, and then I realized, you know, everybody who studies with them sounds exactly like them. There's this whole team out in the world now of former students of them that sound just like them. So I said, I should probably get out of this. So,
was that your first?
This is going
formal?
On and on and on.
That's great. Was that your first kind of like formal teacher?
It was. Yeah, thing? It was actually. Yeah. Yeah, Glenn, and then one of his students, Lane Redmond. I played with her for a long time. I was the first. She had this band in New York called the Mob of Angels, and it was all women. And I integrated that band. I was the first male ever in that band. And then I studied with Glenn again for a while. But again, it became like, oh, I'm just imitating these people. I'm like doing their thing, and I didn't know how to get out of that. Like there didn't seem to be a way of getting out of this. And but then while I was studying with them, Lane actually showed up for rehearsal one time with a box of cassettes and CDs, and stuff she didn't like. And she was just giving them to her students. She said, yeah, if you want any of this. And there was a cassette called, and all it said on it was Music from Home. And I said, well, what's that? And she said, oh, my brother-in-law gave it to me. I have no idea. He's Iranian. It must be Iranian music. So I took it and I got it at home and I listened to it. And this was another one of those like mind-blown moments. Like, what is that? I have never heard anything like that. That's the most beautiful music I have ever heard. How do I get that? How do I find that? So I, I'm glad we have an hour because this is going on forever.
Was that just a drum?
It was an orchestra. It was a Persian orchestra. And I didn't know what it was. You know, all it said was Music from Home. But I got in touch with, I went to Tower Records at the time. I went to the Iranian music section. I bought a few other things and I figured out like what the instruments were. And I was able to do that. So I figured out what the main... There's only a few percussion instruments in most Persian music. You know, there's some tribal stuff. So I figured out what was going on there. And I got in touch with an organization in New York called the World Music Institute, who bring in people from all over the world to perform. And I said, are there any Iranian classical percussionists in New York that I could study with? And they gave me... two names or maybe three names, and I called the first guy, and he said, "Oh, I would love to teach you, but my wife made me give up music. He said she wanted me to concentrate on my job." So I said, "Okay." He said, "Call the other guy. He's very good." So I called him, and I started studying with him, a guy named Kavu Shirzadian, who had gone to he'd studied at Tehran University in the 70s, moved here to be an American, because he came to New York and went to Times Square and said, this is it, this is where I want to be. Sleazy Times Square in the 70s New York. This is it, this is where I want to be. Great guy. So I started studying with him at his, my weekly lesson at his rug shop, because he sold and repaired rugs. So we'd get there and he'd roll out the rug and we'd sit and he taught me like straight on, like how he learned at Tehran University, right? Like, you know, he brought the books. I read, I studied from the books. And that was like my formal musical education, that couple of years that I studied with him. That was the beginning of it, at least. And that became, I guess that was my last thing that I zeroed in on. Like, you know, the things before that were like, this guy's style, that guy's style, this guy's style, that guy's style. And then I got this country style. You know, as I started studying this, you know, Persian music, I started studying Persian music. And I studied with him until he moved. He moved to Virginia. But then right after that, he had introduced me to a guy that I ended up playing with for 7 years, a Persian guy. And we, you know, we played at the UN. You know, we represented Iran at the UN one time. I'm Irish American, so and we played at all these events. We played at all these, you know, the like poetry festivals and all this stuff. And all the, you know, we played at the Iranian ambassador's residence one time for a holiday party. And all these people were coming up to me and started talking to me in Farsi. And I have no idea what you're saying. I'm really sorry. Oh, really? I thought you were... I thought you were Persian. No, no, no. So I did that for, you know, 7 years, I think. Pretty much that was my focus. That was it. And it's a very intricate style. I actually brought one of the drums. I wanted to play a little bit in a little while because... Because it's really everything I do now comes out of that. Not everything, but a lot of, you know, a huge percentage of it comes out of not only the feel of how you play it, but the sound itself. Like I built my percussion kit, and I didn't know I was doing this at first, but it turns out I was doing it to make a polyphonic version of this monophonic drum. You know, basically, this is a one-headed drum, so you can only get a certain number of tones out of it. I wanted to get more tones, so I built a larger kit. But it has very much a similar character. But I left out a part. There was a... Way back, after the industrial thing, I started going to the original knitting factory in New York and seeing some of the improv stuff there.
That's an important part.
I guess I should have left... should have put that in, yeah. So I had seen Zena Parkins and Fred Frith play. That was actually at CBGB's. But so I was familiar with all these people. But I hadn't really paid much attention in a long time. So I bought that record and I said, that's great. I'd forgotten about this stuff. That was fantastic. I should try to do some improv again. Yes, I totally left out the part that really relates to the whole Creative Music Guild thing. Isn't that funny? Yeah, completely left that out. Yeah. We can get back to that.
Well, but that's interesting because it sounds like you started with playing metal.
Yeah.
Like a not metal, right. Like as in like Metallica.
Yeah, yeah.
But like you started by playing German industrial inspired metal.
Exactly, metal instruments, yeah.
So your first band must have been interesting, unlike most, like my first band, which was not. And then at some point you got into like the downtown New York scene. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Well, that was, I don't know how that, oh, I, actually I do. I know exactly how that happened. So I was going to see a friend of mine played me Fred Frith's Guitar on the Table record. I don't know if you've ever heard that one. Mm-hmm. Great record. Live in Japan. I think it's a double, came out as a box set, I think originally. It's all Guitar on the Table. Yeah. So I had heard of him. And I saw that he was playing with his band Skeleton Crew. So it was him and Tom Cora, and they had just added Zena Parkins. They were playing at CBGB's with a couple other bands. I'm pretty sure it was the Orthotonics. I can't remember which one it was. And a few others. So I went to that. And yeah, that kind of blew me away too, because it was, they had all these instruments, half of them were homemade. They just built all these things. And I'll never forget Tom Cora was playing on one song. He was playing the rhythm. He had a board, there's a piece of pine on his lap with a contact mic on it. And he was tossing a beanbag onto it and then tossing a little length of chain over and over. Womp, 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 dink, womp, dink. That was the rhythm track of the thing. While he was, and I think he was also playing cello somehow while he was doing that.
Jeez.
And Zena Parkins had this harp also made out of 2x4s. It looked like it was like really rough. Somebody had just whacked it together for her. So I got very interested in that. And I found out that the Knitting Factory had just opened on Houston Street. The original Knitting Factory was a tiny little space. And so I started going there a lot. I don't honestly remember how many people I saw. So that influenced my first band was like this electronics player, who uh, I don't even know what he was playing. This was the mid 80s, so they were like early samplers. In a couple seconds you could get on it, and it sounded like it came out of an AM radio when it processed through. And we had one other guy for a while. I don't even remember what he played. But I remember coming back from there. I just saw these things at this place called the Knitting Factory, and they were doing this stuff. Let's do that. What were they doing? I don't know. They were just making it up. Let's do that. Let's try that. Okay.
That was your first band?
No. That was like my second or third band. Well, but still, like the first one was a noise band that a friend of mine asked me to join. He was a guitar player. And it actually happened because I got broken up with. This girl broke up with me in college, and he felt bad. He said, I'm going to a music store. They're having a going out of business sale. Want to come with me? And I said, yeah, why not? I got nothing else to do. And I ended up buying a bass. And he said, do you want to play in my band? I said, I don't know how to play. He said, that's all right. And he was a great guitar player. And he just wanted something unusual, I guess. So he got me. Because I had no concept of music. I had none. I did not understand that there was such a thing as keys. Like, so I was trying to play this bass without understanding that there was such a thing as a key signature, like that there was actually any reason to the way the notes went together. I'm like, well, I don't know. This one sounds pretty good with this one. I'll do that.
Okay. We're going to stop right here. This conversation with Matt is so good that we decided to break it up into two episodes. So come back next month and listen to the second half with Matt Hanifin. The Creative Music Guild is an all-volunteer nonprofit whose mission is to support and promote creative and improvised music. Check us out at www.creativemusicguild.org.